so they used lag bulbs that were too long and went through all the glass, so they essentially broke every pane in the building.
But the station is now broadcasting regularly again with the old staff.
Station is now broadcasting. Everybody is back except, and very significantly, and it remains again a major issue, Nicole Sawaya, the station manager, and Larry Bensky, who are not back and are not getting paid. So
are they allowed in the station, or they are?
They've been in the station. They broadcast, but they're not being paid. Mm-hmm. So we're in a very uncertain period, and the organizing has to continue, and the vigilance has to continue.
Is it continuing, or has this sort of tactical move by Pacifica kind of defang the mass protest?
Well, I don't think people are being arrested right now, but I don't think it's defanged anything. And I think the one of the things that's happening is a concentrated effort to make national the protest and to develop a national movement around this on both coasts and in between. And with the ultimate goal of getting rid of the people who brought this crisis on and changing the governing structure so there really is genuine community input. And so that's happening on all levels, including a number of lawsuits that are, one lawsuit's already been filed, others contemplated, and just ongoing.
What is the motivation, do you think, of District Attorney John Adams in pursuing the cases against the protesters when it appears that the, there's some sort of deal that's been reached? At least that's the face, or the spin that KPFA's Pacifica Board, I should say, is trying to throw on this.
Well, there hasn't been any deal reached, and I'm not a district attorney and don't want to try and think like a district attorney, but I really don't know. But one thing is that I think that this would be a really opportune time to put pressure on the district attorney's office for people to call and write.
Do you happen to know the phone number of the district attorney?
I don't have it right now.
Perhaps we can get that. It would seem to me, though, and I'm just naive, and I'm a traveler through Berkeley, but isn't this an attempt, sort of a message, we're going to continue to harass and prosecute protesters to make it tough for subsequent protests? Or is this just some cranky crotchet that the district attorney has for protesters generally? I don't know anything about John Adams or his department, and it's not, I know you're not inside his mind, but certainly you've seen him in similar situations. Does he go after most protesters this way?
Well, I think he's actually kind of new here, but what I could guess, and I actually have no information, is that they are concerned that there will be more problems at Pacifica, that the crisis won't be resolved, there'll be more protests, which there very well may be. I think the mistake is the belief that anything they do is going to stop the protests or stop people from committing civil disobedience, if that's appropriate. I mean, that's never happened. There's a long, long history of this in Berkeley, going back to the free speech movement, and if the cause is just and if the action seems necessary, people are going to do it. And, the DA is not going to affect people's political decisions. But he's a DA.
Finally, a kind of a touchy question, which was on my mind after reading some articles from the Anderson Valley Advertiser recently about the history of KPFA. This isn't the first time that KPFA has begun to vanillaize or throw out unpopular or different people that didn't like dissident voices. William Mandel was dismissed, back in 1994, and other KPFA commentators were thrown out. And the folks that are now being thrown out, as I understand it, generally said very little about that. They kept a low profile, they kept their heads down. Is this a fair characterization that now suddenly the chickens are coming home to roost to them, and maybe they're beginning to smell the coffee, to use a metaphor? But I guess some folks looking in on the situation wonder, the new heroes of the hour, Bensky and Osmond and so forth, weren't such heroes 4 years ago. Have they essentially become more courageous, changed their spots, or is it just now their ox that's getting gored?
Well, I think there's a lot of reevaluation going on in the history. And it's true that in 1995 there was a number of people were dismissed from the station, lost their slots, and there was people organized around that, the whole Save KPFA group that organized around that. And it's true that many of those people are now, with some legitimacy, saying, "We told you so," and now in retrospect is appearing to people that what happened then was a foretaste of a change that was being engineered that people didn't sufficiently recognize and or struggle against. And that there are many, as with any movement, there are many contradictions and tensions within it. And what has been remarkable is that the level of unity that's been achieved around the fact that this, whatever the history, this needs to be challenged and fought, and also around the fact that this is not just a struggle with Pacifica, but that it is at the same time a call for an internal transformation of KPFA to make it more accessible and responsive to the community.
At the same time this is happening, the FCC is considering, I guess a deadline was August 5th or August 10th, I'm not sure, micro-power stations, the fate of such stations as, I guess, what's now called Liberation Radio Berkeley, or Berkeley Liberation Radio, Santa Cruz's Free Radio, San Francisco Liberation Radio, many, I would say, probably dozens, if not scores, of stations across the country. There's a lot of attention on KPFA, but not much attention on this micro-power crisis. I don't want to seem jealous, because I do, I operate out of a micro-power station. Do you see the chance of there being some sort of positive synergy in these struggles to have the KPFA, folks who are supporting KPFA, also realize the importance of micro-power stations as independent alternatives and oppose FCC's attempts to restrict and act as the mouthpiece of the National Association of Broadcasters?
Right. I mean, it's all part of the same struggle, which is to keep a community-based and diverse and oppositional voice out in the world and access to the means of getting that, a different point of view and an oppositional point of view out into the world. And certainly the, you know, micro radio is part of it, and keeping the, you know, the Pacifica responsive to the community is part of it. I mean, the overall picture is that there's a consolidation taking place where corporate control of not only the airways, but of, you know, everything from the air we breathe to the toothpaste we buy is being more and more a factor in our lives. And so this is part of that anti-corporate, anti-consolidation struggle. And micro-radio is part of it, and the struggle for control of Pacifica is part of it. Yeah.
Well, for what began as a five-minute interview, I want to thank you for giving me half an hour.
Sure.
Anything you want to conclude with?
The struggle is not over, and people have to be vigilant.
We've been talking to Osha Newman, attorney, activist, and occasional writer, as well as painter. I've seen this man painting up on Telegraph Avenue as well. Thanks, Osha.
Okay.
And that was Osha Newman, attorney, activist, and Berkeley artist. And now on the phone with us, we have live from Oakland, Alade. And Alade, give me your full name. I'm going to keep working on that.
It's okay. It's going to take a little while there, Robert. It's Alade Jehudi Mus, son of Charles Vaughn Sr., who was murdered by the Seaside Police Department on May 19th, 1998.
And we've spoken, I guess, about 6 months ago, when 2 or 3 months ago you were in the middle of a fast, because the initial concern about this shooting, which happened in Seaside, in May of 1998?
Yeah.
It was done, I guess, with the cold instruction, cap him if he if he moves toward you, that was the some such phrase.
Right.
With respect to your father. And
right. I think, Robert, the one thing, first I would like to start off by thanking the listeners of Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 for their continued support throughout the year that my father had been killed, and as well as the time that I was actually on the hunger strike. It was 2 days after I spoke to you and asked your listeners to phone the Justice Department that they gave into the demand to meet with us earlier. I was actually going on to the 17th day, so I would, you know, I need to start off by showing my appreciation and, first of all, wishing I could have gotten back earlier, but I've recently gotten the strength to get out, and I've just began to attend events. I attended my first event not too long ago, a couple days ago, and it turned out that another person was killed, as I mentioned to you, a young man in Fremont by the name of Rosenberg was actually murdered by the cops down there, and his father showed up at one of our meetings. I'm a member of FAMLY, Families Against Murder by Law Enforcement, and it's a group of approximately 45 active family members who have lost family members to police violence. And I explained to you earlier, it's one of those groups that we don't want to see get larger, but unfortunately it does happen, and then we have to move in to support that family. If I could just set the stage, Robert, excuse me from the noise behind me, if I could set the stage and tell them briefly about my father. My father, Charles Bond Sr., was a retired school teacher. I myself grew up in the Santa Cruz area when my father was getting his bachelor's from University of Santa Cruz. I believe he got it from Merrill College. And so I grew up on that campus and am very familiar with the community. We were there in the 70s, and my father moved on down to Seaside on the Monterey Peninsula, where he got his master's degree at Monterey Institute of Foreign Studies, as well as he was a PhD candidate as well.
You're both African American.
Yes, and by the way, we are both African American. Mm-hmm. The one thing that that I was really fortunate is that in addition to my father being an instructor or a professor, he was also an activist. And so through the times when the Panthers were active and other organizations in the community were there, my father was always seen as the mediator, the person that the groups would come. I remember when I was a child, and the groups would actually come to my house late at night, and they would have meetings under candlelight to actually settle disputes. And so my father played a really pivotal role during the time period when there was some tension within the community, as well as he was an activist. He was one of the founders of the Black Teachers Union and the Modern Unified School District. And so, you know, I had this foundation that I grew up with and the footsteps that I wanted to follow and were clearly my father's. The one thing that I failed to mention early on, that my father, while he was at UC Santa Cruz, we realized that he actually had a mental illness. And it was something that we as a family, that my father had become accustomed to over the years, because he not only got his education, but in addition, he continued to teach until he retired. Well, I'm going to speed the process up with you because of, in the interest of time.
No, please take your time a lot, because I know that although you've talked about this, it probably sounds like repetitious to you, but to those of us and to many new listeners who are tuning in, you know, you're giving information that they don't know.
Right. Well, what happened was I wanted to provide the foundation. I have to give you a couple more points on who my father was and what he meant not only to the family but to the community, which in return was why the community stood up and continues to stand for him and his killing. In addition to that, he was a graduate from Monterey Peninsula College. He was one of the very first, and I, of course, you know, I'm proud to hear when they say it. He was an All-American football player, and one, I think what they say he had was the best that ever played there in the position he played, as well as later in life he was drafted to go play for the Chicago Bears, which he didn't do. He decided to pursue his education. He was the founder of the the Ethnic Studies Department. When I say he, I want to make sure you understand it. My father didn't operate in a vacuum. I'm speaking about him because he is the subject, but he never operated alone, which I want to say that it was always within the context of the community and other concerned individuals, because of the one thing that the police thought they were doing on that particular day, May 19th, 1998, that they were killing an individual, when in fact, what we learned was that once someone does good within the community, people will stand when it's a wrongful action. And so what happened was, on Malcolm X's birthday, which is, of course, May 19th, happens to be the same date that my father was murdered. Another ironic situation is we have this president, or let me say ex-president, Ronald Reagan, who was the one who basically decided that people with mental illness would either be better off in jail or dead, is now himself suffering from Alzheimer's. I think one of the things that are ironic, how things are circular, and I only bring that up because it was an article I read today that brought that to mind. Now, May 19th, I was sitting at my job, got a call, my mother stating to me that my father had been shot. And of course, you can't imagine the thoughts that go through your head on who would shoot your dad. There's, you know, and the fact that my father had lived within the community for 30 plus years, that was known by practically everyone within the community, the last on the list, despite I know they had a vicious reputation for blood, was the Seaside Police.
Now, Seaside, for those who don't know, is a little community just north of Monterey, south of Santa Cruz. It's predominantly African-American, is that accurate?
Well, at this point in time, it's predominantly minority. I would say that the majority is African-American, with a highly concentrated area of Latinos and others. The one thing that we have there that is really unique is the diversity, because of most of the people who initially came there were a result of the Army base, Fort Ord, prior to it closing. Mm-hmm. And because of the fact that they didn't want African-Americans in Monterey, they didn't want them in Carmel, Seaside was the place that became the melting pot. So it's a very diverse environment. Unfortunately, that has nothing to do with the brutality that is inflicted on its citizens.
Was the police department largely African-American as well?
Well, I can tell you this. There was an FBI investigation a couple of years ago, and there was a group down there called the Aryan Brotherhood of Cops, and it only were revealed because one of the cops who had to be Caucasian actually turned and went to the League of Latin American Citizens president and informed him of the actions of these rogue cops. So the fact that, and it was an African-American chief of police at that time, but at the same time, those elements, the one thing, when you're talking about a quasi-military operation, color doesn't matter. It is where we go back to the code of silence. And so it's hard sometimes when we hear of a lot of the cases of brutality is white on black, but a lot of times you do have African-Americans and other minorities who have come to identify the victimization of the citizens. That's just the normal routine practice. So the fact that the two cops that actually pulled the trigger on my father were white were not necessarily reflective of it only being a race issue, because the one who ordered my father to be killed was African-American. And so I don't think that we can really draw upon that, although one of the officers who did pull the trigger on my father also was involved in the killing of another mentally ill black man, and was found in court to have lied that, you know, basically they said they didn't choke him off, and they choked him off. And
the name of that officer was?
That was Joseph Bartanius. There's three officers that we're talking about here. The African-American, his name is Lewis Lumpkin. You have Ronald Guth and Joseph Bartania.
And who did Joseph Bartania also kill with some kind of a chokehold, you said?
Yeah, it was some kind of chokehold with the way they tied him up. His name was Albert Macklin.
And where did this happen?
That happened at Seaside as well.
And when was that?
That was a few years prior to my father's death.
Now, you mentioned when you came through Santa Cruz a year ago with the Stolen Lives Project, which is, of course, has many relatives of people killed by the police, that one of these officers is originally from Santa Cruz?
There's one that's supposed to have had a past. The one thing that we were told that it was Joseph Bertania. Now, as we look further into this, it seems that he had another pass out of the San Joaquin area as well. So we're not really for sure how he came through there. It was the identification. We came to support the community for the celebration of the life of Happy John Dine, that was pointed out to us.
Because I know that, you know, back in 1980, 81, 82, there was a scandal in the Santa Cruz Police Department, the Code Blue scandal, where homeless people were being beaten and indeed some say killed by local Santa Cruz police officers. I guess the police chief resigned. A number of the police officers either resigned or were fired. Indictments came down, but they never amounted to anything.
Right.
And I was trying to remember.
And from my understanding, Joseph Bertania is one of those officers.
I see.
That's my understanding of his role coming through Santa Cruz. Let me say this, is that it is standard operating procedure that when a cop is about to either be fired or to be charged, they let the officer go so that he can go or she can go to another department and be able to start their career all over again. So it is nothing. It's nothing new. And in regards to their records in Seaside, they're lengthy enough. They have enough court cases filed against them on just outrageous brutality, which they put on the citizens there. And I'm in particular the citizens that have suffered the most have been Black and Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And this is well documented. It's nothing new. And the cities across this country are in the same way, and this is the order of business, and it's acceptable because the people have not stood up in as the way that it's going to happen. The new millennium is going to offer a whole bunch of new avenues, and it's not just going to be for their technology, it's going to be for the people to understand that there is a difference between human rights and human rights abuses, and we have to qualify them as such so that we will have the vehicle and the spotlight that will allow us to say these murders that are occurring need the same attention that you're paying to other countries. We can go to Kosovo and ask for some support and go in there under the human rights guise, but yet you have hundreds of people in this country that are being killed. And when I say being killed, I mean outright killed. Let me set this setting for you, though, Robert,
mm-hmm.
because I think some of your listeners, although who are new to it, I think they need to understand what really transpired. On May 19th, what happened was social service workers had come to my father's house, knocked on his door. When they came to my father came to the door and said, wait just a minute. And she said, it's Teresa, it was social worker Teresa Cox. So what happens is, he opens up the door, and he goes, I told you last week I no longer wanted your services. And she goes, okay, we just came to see how you were doing. He says, I'm doing fine. I don't need any medication. I am fine. And she said, okay, bye. Based on that conversation, and I'm telling you because I've read it frontwards and backwards, and there was another social worker, and they both gave identical statements, identical to the police and what my father responded to. But when the police showed up, they said he hadn't been taking his medication. He was delusional. But the thing was, because of all the
social workers called the police, right?
Yes. They called them based on the fact that they didn't ask my father to go with them when they came to the door. All they asked to say was to come see how you were doing. And the social worker's response was, what they said was that he told the police he was delusional. And so we went back to look in the records and what they told the district attorney. So nothing was delusional there. But
what did they say was, what delusion did he have at that time?
Actually didn't elaborate on it because of what they said. He said was very logical. I no longer want your services. Thank you very much. That was it.
Now, had he been court ordered to retain their services?
No, he'd never been on a court order to retain any services.
I see. So in other words, he was simply telling them, I'm in the privacy of my own home, thank you for coming, but I don't want your help. And he didn't, there was no indication in the report that he was threatening them or acting in an abusive...
Absolutely none.
I see.
Absolutely none. And that's how come it's critical, it's in these types of cases, it's critical, because you have to go back and do an analysis, because what you want to do is you want to prevent this from happening again. So if we clearly just focus on the police, we're going to have a problem.
Now, these mental health workers, are they still employed by
the... Of course. What they found was that they did an internal investigation. Theirs was worse than the police. The police at least took like 2 weeks. It took about a month to come up with their stories. But the social workers, they came back about a week later and said, our house is clean. But we know that's not. But the problem what you have when you're dealing with legal lawsuits in regards to social workers is they have a real immunity. They have this immunity that's fairly high, or not, it's actually higher than the police.
So both the police and the social workers involved in your father's death are still carrying their guns and their Thorazine hypodermics.
Right, right.
And I'm gonna have you describe it in more detail, but just to let those know who didn't already know, your father was killed for allegedly, what, wielding a corkscrew?
No, it's not even wielding a corkscrew. See, because Robert, the last time I talked to you, I was in the midst of the hunger strike and really couldn't explain to you what has transpired.
Go ahead.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Because of what happens is, I wanted to be clear. So what happens is social workers go next door to call the police show up. Now, one of the police that show up was the African American. And I want to tell you guys this. When I was at Monterey Peninsula College myself, playing football, there was a gentleman who played football with me. His name was Lewis Lumpkin.
And that was the man. Huh?
That was the officer. Now, in addition to that, this was before he had aspirations, I think, of being a cop. He was just another student like me. Mm-hmm. I even introduced him to his wife. This is the level of treachery and that I'm trying to get to. Mm-hmm. Is listen, he shows up on the scene. First of all, the social worker, in her competency, she tells the ambulance driver she wants him to sign this 5150 waiver. And this woman, supposedly now they come out saying she had the authority to do it, right? She's asking the ambulance driver to sign a 5150 waiver. The guy goes, I can't do that.
Now, for those who don't know, a 5150 waiver is an assertion that an individual is severely disabled or a danger to himself or others and so can be held involuntarily for 72 hours in a mental ward, right?
Or you left one out, it's danger to yourself, danger to someone else, or gravely disabled.
Right.
So those are the three criteria.
Mm-hmm.
So first she asked this guy who's driving the ambulance, and he says, that's not my job, I don't do that. So now when the police show up, this one cop shows up, which was Lewis Lumpkin. He shows up on the scene, and she tells him that I want to get him housed, I wanted to get him to take his medication, and in addition to that, he's delusional.
In other words, you wanted to have him kidnapped and forcibly shot up with drugs.
There's no other way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
He had a right to say no, which he did.
Even though there was no court order justifying this, even though he had not acted in a threatening manner towards her, did she?
Not only that, Robert, Lewis Lumpkin in the district attorney's report states he did not witness anything that was either dangerous to Mr. Vaughn, to anyone else, prior to Mr. Vaughn going on the roof. Now, let me get people to this point.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is they're knocking on the door. At this point in time, my dad looks out the window and he sees the police there. So now he's going into a whole different mode. He's saying, hold it. I'm not coming out. I haven't done anything. And so they keep knocking. My father goes out his back window. Now, I want you to understand this. I've never in my entire life seen my father run of fear. I'm talking about 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen him fear anything. And the fact that my father is now running, so he climbs out the back of his window. There's a shed in the back about 4 feet high. He climbs on the shed, and he goes and sits on his ass on top of the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sitting on top of the roof, Robert. I want you to follow me.
This is a two-story building?
No, it's a one-story building.
Uh-huh.
It's not a big... He lived in a modest place.
Mm-hmm.
He climbed on the shed, which was about 4 feet. He then climbs onto the roof, and he sits on his butt. He's sitting up on his butt. Now, what we didn't know before, until we got the district attorney's report, was that Lewis Lumpkin had been harassing my father.
Louis Lumpkin
on previous occasions.
He stated in the report that this is how deep it was. It wasn't a simple encounter. Louis Lumpkin said my father hated him. But yet Louis Lumpkin is the aggressor from the very point of his time on the scene.
Now, had there been previous encounters between Lumpkin and your father?
Well, you know, that's interesting. But Lumpkin said there was. But then in the report he said he never arrested my dad, but he says when he seen my father in the laundromat, listen to this, or sitting on a bus bench after he's eaten at McDonald's. He said my father was loitering, and therefore he had to go there to tell my father to quit loitering.
Loitering in the neighborhood in which he lived.
Not only that.
Loitering after having purchased something from a nearby cafe, sitting down trying to enjoy
you're just living like any other citizen in this country. But what I'm trying to say is this. We didn't know that this animosity existed prior to that. So what happens is my father is now sitting on his ass on the perch of this roof, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lumpkin at this point climbs on top of the shed, he orders him to come down. My father said, no, I haven't done anything. He says, if you don't come down, I'm going to spray you with mace. Robert.
Is this mace or pepper spray we're talking?
It's our OC.
Okay, pepper spray, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what it is one of the officers who called into the control center said that he's on the roof and he has a stabbing instrument. And they said, but then in the district attorney's report, he goes, well, I knew it was a corkscrew, but I thought they would have thought it was funny if I'd have said it was a corkscrew. Well, ain't nothing funny about it.
How long was the corkscrew?
It was a corkscrew. It was a typical, whatever, what is a corkscrew?
It's about usually 2 or 3 inches.
Okay, and it's about an inch. And so what happens is you have a corkscrew, you have the butterflies on it. You know, you got the little butterflies on it. Well, let me just get you to the point,
Sure.
This is where we're at. Is as my father's sitting on the roof, the guy begins to spray him. Now my father's cussing at this guy who's spraying at him, and he's taunting him. He's like, come and get me. Come and get me. I'm not coming down. I haven't done anything. I'm not coming down. And at the very last time, according to the ambulance driver, is that he heard my father say, you just come and get me. Lumpkin appears on the roof. Now what we didn't know and we do know now is that he told the other two officers that I'm going to go on the roof, and when I go on the roof, if he stands up to cap him, or what he said was if he stands up and comes at me to cap him. Cap him in any sense means shoot to kill. Officers, you guys know police don't shoot to wound. So in fact, I want to tell you this. My father was laying on his stomach, and why was he laying on his stomach? The officer decided to provoke him. Now, what is really interesting is that sometimes what you have to do is you have to put yourself in the position of the person who's done the wrong. I don't mean to go back and shoot, but to see it from that. So we went back to the scene, and we looked at the report that he gave. And the context that he put it in was that he noticed citizens gathering, and he became concerned that Mr. Vaughn would jump off the roof. Because they had the perimeter. They had an officer in front, three in the back. They said they thought he was going to jump off the roof. This is a 60-year-old man going to jump off a 15-foot roof.
And attack pedestrians with a corkscrew.
But this was the key, Robert. This is the key. If not only that, this officer said he noticed these citizens gathering. Mm-hmm. And the reason why he decided to provoke the incident was because he wanted to protect them. But, you know, sometimes when we try to cover things up, you know, you begin to dot. We used to dot in the I's and crossing the T's. But what happened is we start to look close at this because you don't dot a U. So things start to look too pretty. It was too clean. So we went back and we got where that dirty cop was, where Louis Lumpkin was on that shed. And lo and behold, he had no view. You understand me? He could not see if anybody was in the front. So the pretext that he gave for forcing the confrontation is a bald-faced lie.
So he didn't claim that he got this through radio analysis, but he claimed he actually saw it.
He said, I noticed. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what the FBI, they tried to write it off. When we met with the FBI, they tried to write it off and said, well, hate doesn't mean, you know, because we can hate a person. it's so funny how when you're with your brethren, how hate doesn't mean the same thing. But you ask that Filipino man who died at the hands of hate down in Los Angeles, or those Jewish children who were at the end of those bullets, what the hell hate meant. Hate is hate, no matter how you spell it. Now, don't try to soften it.
So Lumpkin killed your father.
Lumpkin ordered the killing.
So what
happens is, once you, they start to see the picture, they, the Justice Department said, well, maybe it's kind of like the case in the prisons. When a prison guard didn't like someone in the prison, they would set up a fight and have the guards up in the tower shoot down.
Mm-hmm.
So they know what the format of this killing is.
Mm-hmm. So there were, how many bullets killed your father?
They fired at least 7 to 8 bullets. And, you know, enough of them hit him. He was hit in the back, you know, it wasn't about that. What it was about was an individual who they determined was not going to defend himself. He could no longer defend, the community wouldn't defend himself. But what they were wrong about was that the ties that my father had were stronger than their bullets. My father's best friend who's the godfather of my younger brother and sister, Mel Mason, they immediately went into action, a lot of people in the Santa Cruz area know Mel Mason,
mm-hmm.
from his political activism, and began to organize. And the community began to organize. The community began to respond.
Now, I know that the Monterey Peninsula Herald carried, almost a story every day about the shooting, although the Santa Cruz Sentinel carried very little. And, of course, when we had our own killing of Happy John Dine, it was quickly buried by the media and by the police and the DA. But your either community organizing efforts or superior media, I know what...
It's not... Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The first story they did was actually a hit piece on my father. It had nothing to do with the superior media. It had everything to do with the response of the people. If the people respond, the powers to be will listen. Although they never... It's very hard for them to ever say that my father was laying on his stomach. Although every report says that, you will not find that in any report in the Monterey Herald. So there are certain things that they just couldn't bring themselves to do.
Because admitting that he was laying on his stomach would indicate he was in a passive position and that an innocent and harmless person was killed.
There you go, right here. That's it in a nutshell.
So you began organizing, and again, the media, as I said, I was very impressed with the fact that there were continuing reports in the media, one story after another. I was trying to pick up every one of these stories as they came out, and I guess that there was a call for an investigation by what advocacy and
there was many calls. There was calls put out by the local. There was the Charles Monsignor Task Force that called for an investigation, the ACLU, the Salinas, NAACP.
Was an investigation ever actually undertaken?
Well, let me get to that. There was Congresswoman Maxine Waters. There was Jesse Jackson. So there was a lot of people who did come in and call for an investigation. But what really happened was not one person from the Justice Department ever telephoned us. Not one person ever sent us a letter. We had sent them numerous letters, and nobody had received any responses. And so what happened, and that's what brought us to the one-year anniversary of his murder. See, and they, because of, they expected that the community would become soft and that they could easily bury this like they did with Happy John Dine.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was...
Let me ask you this. Most murder is considered to be a state rather than a federal crime in most cases. Yet you were concerned with going to the feds. Is that because you felt you were more likely to get justice there? Why?
Yeah, well, I mean, under Title 18, Section 241 and 242, one is excessive force, which is 242, and 241, which is conspiracy, is the avenue that police have actually been charged with and actually sent to jail with on a very few and limited occasions.
You're saying that in the main, when that state district attorneys will simply not investigate and prosecute police.
Not only will not investigate, which is they're in bed together.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the daily interaction between the officers, it's one hand feeds another. So just say if he charges these officers in Seaside, the local district attorney, Dean Flip, charges these officers with a crime, then they won't be forthcoming on other information that will make the DA look good when it comes to certain cases. So it is no way that they can police each other. And basically what happened was, what made this even more apparent as a murder was the fact that Dean Flipple had, he left out the key instigator, and it was Lewis Lumpkin. He only evaluated the two shooters. Mm-hmm. And because of the two shooters, Joseph Britannia and Ronald Guff,
the white man from the street,
were feeling the pressure. They turned on Lumpkin, saying, hold it, hold it, hold it, because it was the fear and the amount of pressure from the people. They said, hold it. Lumpkin gave us the orders to cap him.
But in the end, all of them are still on the department?
In the end, which is standard, Mark Garcia, who's was killed up here in San Francisco.
His brother Daniel actually came to Santa Cruz recently. Yeah.
And of course, Danny's a member of Family and Stolen Lives. Captain Sir, who was involved in his brother's death, was promoted to like chief of the mission district. And I just got word last week that Ronald Guff was promoted to sergeant. So there is an internal reward for these types of operations as long as they're successful. This one's not over yet. That's the one thing that they know that, and you will see the silence come for them until the last.
Now, on May 19th, a year later, you, after seeing a year of inaction from the Justice Department, you decided to go on a hunger strike.
Yeah, it took me a little while to get there because I knew that things were getting old and I wasn't satisfied. I knew that my father's life had been taken. He was assassinated. And the last thing that a son, in my opinion, can do to a father who rewarded him with a rich life and taught me right from wrong and integrity and courage and honesty, that I had to do what I had to do. And it was basically to go on a complete hunger strike, drink only water, until these demands that I had put forth were met. And the one thing about this, Robert, was that I had told no one that this was coming up, you know, and so there were a lot of people who were angry at me because of the fact that there was no preparation time, and which means that they had to start from scratch when it came to the media, and my body would begin to deteriorate a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. And your demands were
the
for,
demands,
right?
Robert, the demands, when I say my demands, they were the demands of the Charles E. Vaughn Sr. Mental Health Police Practice Task Force, mm-hmm. chaired by Mel Mason.
That had already been established.
That had already been established. They weren't my particular demands. They were, one, that the Seaside Police begin immediate training on mental health, because after they killed that, there was a couple killings. The one thing about it is there was a guy, Ferdinand Pasqua, a Filipino gentleman in Marina, the town adjacent to Seaside, who was killed. And the Alliance for Mentally Ill came and said, let us train all the police on the Monterey Peninsula, including Seaside. Seaside rejected it. Seaside police then killed Albert Macklin, which included Joseph Britannia, one of the officers involved in my father's death. They came and said, let us train your officers again, because you have another death, and this time it's on your hands. And they refused again to get that training.
Do you have any indication why?
You know what? I would have to say it can't be anything besides stupidity and ignorance.
Stubbornness?
Because one would think it would be the lawsuit, but because Albert Macklin had a real old mother in the house when he was killed, they gave her like $20,000 in funeral costs and stuff like that. And she's really old, so she was the witness, so they were able to shut that up. But it's beyond me. It has to be ignorance. It really has to be ignorance.
So, one of the demands was that the Seaside Police Department be retrained. The other three demands
were... number one was that the Seaside Police begin immediate training, not some distant future, but immediate. Number two was that the County of Monterey released a book that was developed after my father's killing that would be used for all of the whole peninsula's police department, including the sheriff and the rest of the police departments there. Number three was that the congressman, which you guys are familiar with, Sam Farr, find money for crisis intervention teams, which are very, very important in these types of incidents. When you don't have a police action, why the hell are the police up front with their guns drawn? Mm-hmm. this was clearly, it was one of those things. So the third demand at that point was that the congressman find funding for these crisis intervention teams. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the one that we're still waiting for was that the Justice Department begin an active investigation. But in addition to beginning this active investigation, they'd be required to get information, not only from my family, but from others within the community who had it, and that they could not use an agent from the local FBI agent in Monterey. That was the key.
Because
when there's a bank robbery, that though the FBI agent has the interactions with those police departments again, or any kind of other federal crimes that, you know, money laundering or whatever, they're going to have that interaction.
And have they sent in an FBI agent from out of the area?
Yes, they did. The way it happened was the first week when the hunger strike was announced, everybody stood, would not respond to our demands or to my demands at that point in time. And I have to say, I did have the support of Dick Gregory. I'm pretty sure people in Santa Cruz know who Dick Gregory
is. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so Dick Gregory came in and gave me, you know, the essentials of surviving as long as I could.
Dick Gregory is an activist who has done fasts as long as 30 and 40 years ago to press for basic civil rights issues back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so he prepared me as best be prepared when you go under one of these conditions. And by the end of the first week, the city of Seaside had signed up their officers for training to take place in the next week. And so that part of the puzzle began to unfold.
And did they in fact go for their training?
Yes, they did. And then the next...
Not that I'm terribly happy that that's going to be any kind of solution.
The problem is, Robert, is that the training they went for is the one from this book that was developed after my father's killing. It is an improvement, and it's a step in the right direction. I want to be clear on that. But however, it's definitely inadequate. The training that you'll see out of like Memphis with their critical information teams, crisis intervention teams, they get a minimum of 40 hours. And so 4 hours and 40 hours, you know, it's not really... but I think they're just in the beginning phases because we're not finished as well. So that part of the element was met. Initially, the county denied that there was a book developed after my father's killing, but we had word from the inside, and they released that during the second week. Towards the end of the second week, as the pressure began to mount, because of what happened was you had activists like Bill Melendez from League of Latin American Citizens, Bill Monning, who you guys are familiar with, mm-hmm. from came, and Bill Monning was the first one to come and said, hey, you know, this is a righteous cause, and I want to go on a hunger strike as well.
Uh-huh.
And so by the end of the second week, there was at least 10 individuals who had signed up, you know, and half of the people I didn't know, and people were still calling that they wanted to go on this hunger strike as well, because I think as far as the powers that be, it was better off for me to wither away. But the one thing, I was very spiritual about this. I understood what I was involved with, what was required, and I was committed to following it through. Because once you identify this as your method, your body will not allow you, let me be clear, it will not allow you to be able to proceed until your mind is satisfied that those conditions have been met. It's that strong. So by the end of the second week, like I said, we got the action from the county. The congressmen began to start making calls to us. And by the beginning of the third week, we got a call from the congressman where he said he had located funds for crisis intervention teams. But listen, not just for the city of Seaside, but for counties throughout the U.S. through a funding mechanism through the Justice Department. But the way they have it set up is that it would have to be with matching funds from the county. Okay? So now we're starting to get some action, and then he caps it off. You know, he's a hero. He caps it off by saying, in addition, your father's case will be taken up by the vice president's wife, Tipper Gore, at this mental health conference. And I told her to make it an issue, and please, it'll be on C-SPAN. That's not for us. We understand where we're going. And that was not where we were going, but it all towards stopping this type of unnecessarily violence. Once again, these are small increments. None of this I would consider to be a victory. I want to be clear. and it had nothing to do with Charles Vaughn Jr., who, or Lottie Jehuti Miss, who I am, had nothing to do with that at all, but had everything to do with what happens when the people stand up to a system that is unjust. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so very last, though, so what happens is, Robert, we've accomplished on the local level and on the federal level through the congressman. And, of course, you know, front page, it was big news that he had found this funding. And so, but don't forget, this is, he found the funding, but things still need to go. So we're still working with them. It's an ongoing process. Now, the last one, but not least, was the Justice Department. Now I'm going into my third week, and Dick Gregory is telling me at day 21 the body starts to cannibalize itself off itself, not to be more scared, but just be aware as far as your activities are concerned that you need to reduce, you get what I'm saying? You need to reduce your activities.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, the Justice Department is the last one, and all we want is to meet with them, for them to agree that they're going to do an independent investigation, that they won't use an agent, and they're refusing to meet with us. They're refusing, they're getting land blast. I talked to you on like a Wednesday or a Tuesday on free radio Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm.
and then I went back again to KPFA on Dennis Bernstein's program. And I want you guys to understand is that KPFA, free radio Santa Cruz 96.3, are the not only the voice, but they're the lifeline to any activism that is to succeed. And so when I'm a jump here because of what happened was we went on Dennis Bernstein's program on that day. I was really weak, but the one thing that could happen was that the listeners heard in my voice what was going to go down and how serious I was,
mm-hmm.
and they responded. And not only they responded, because the people from Santa Cruz, and the only reason I found this out was they were telling me, this was on a Thursday, they were telling me at the Justice Department they would refuse to meet with us for another week and a half. And this was day 16. But what happened was we went on that program, we asked people to respond. You get what I'm saying, Robert?
Mm-hmm.
Is that we asked people to respond because not only was my life at stake, but the issue of the Justice Department respond to all of these family killings were at stake. Nobody had ever, none of us in family with over 45 members had ever been contacted by this, by the same organization that we're paying all these tax funds, tax dollars to come in and investigate.
As I remember, you told me that you got a call from the Justice Department official. She was overwhelmed, saying, "Why are all these people calling me?" And she insisted on moving up the date a week to talk to you immediately, right?
Yeah. That was it, is that the people had stood up and they had to listen. And it wasn't, once again, because I was doing this action. It wasn't because I was just a part of it.
Sure.
It was the action of those people who took the time to call. They didn't have to show up. Everybody did what they can do. I can never thank those people from Santa Cruz who did the call, those people who joined in on the whole strike.
We're talking with a lot of Jehuti Mess, is that correct?
Yes, Robert.
Also known as Charles Vaughn Jr. And Alade, I want you to perhaps steel yourself for a future call to the station, because we got to leave now.
Yes.
Let us know what we can do next, because it sounds like even though you got these four demands initiated, that sounds like a piss-poor scene as far as getting some real pressure on these people and getting what we really want out of them, right?
Right. Right now we're into the strategy session. And I'm going to give out a number that we can be reached at, and it's 510-425-1139.
Give that to me again.
510-425-1139. And I would also just like to say October 22nd is, for those who don't know, is the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, the Criminalization of a Generation. And what I would like to tell the people, because the people from Santa Cruz have responded when we had the National Tribunal down in Monterey,
mm-hmm.
but I would also say we have October 22nd coming up again, and I'd like you guys to get hooked in. For those who would like to participate in any way or to help organize a day down in Santa Cruz,
we're going to do that. And
okay, that's beautiful.
We got to run though, because our next talk show host is coming in. What I'm going to do is I'm going to encourage people to give a call to 423 Huff if you want to those numbers repeated, or if you want to be a part of the October 22nd day of protest. And I invite you, Alade, to call again. then, and we can talk about what we should do now. Given where we're at, let's see what our next step is. And I thank you very much for calling in and sharing this grim, real, important story with us.
Robert, thanks as always, and as well, thanks to the listeners from Radio Free Santa Cruz. You guys are in my heart, prayers. We can win this struggle. It's not going to be easy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are out of here. We're not even going to do theme music. We are late. Earth First is coming up next. Tune in again on Sunday, 11 o'clock, for the next edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Unless Dennis wants me to continue talking, he can take it over from here. Uncle Dennis is